All right. Hello and welcome to another episode of Person of Interest with me, Natalie Jones. Hello. I love today's guest because we met so organically. I actually met him in the parking lot with his partner, Stephanie, at a work event. We started talking and we were like, oh, wow, this is great. You should come on. Because William Jackson, he is a life coach. He's an author. He's a motivational speaker. He hosts stuff. And he's also a leadership developer. Now, he wrote a book called When Life Happens, and it's all about skills and tools for life and breaking everything down. He focuses a lot on grief. Let's see, mental health and self-development, which is right up my alley. Oh, and he's also a professional consultant. I mean, he does so much. And if you would like to reach out to William Jackson, you can book him. You can reach him at www.theofficialwilliamjackson.com and on Instagram as The Official William Jackson. Here we go. So it was really nice meeting you. I want to do an official invite. William Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
I met you in a parking lot.
Yes.
At a diamond, at a jewelry store.
Listen, parking lot introductions are the best.
They are.
Yeah.
You
can get a little weird sometimes, but.
I was coming in hot that day. Yeah, whatever. But I met you and your partner, Stephanie, together at, I guess it was like outside of James Free.
Oh, yeah.
And you guys were just fantastic. Before I even like knew who you were or looked up what you just did, just you and Stephanie, I was like, you guys are just great. And then you briefly told me what you did. And I was like, well, you got to come on the podcast. Whatever.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. Definitely excited to be here.
So you are a life coach. How would you describe yourself? You're an author.
Mm-hmm.
You're a published author.
Mm-hmm.
You're a life coach. You're
mm-hmm.
also a motivational speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And what else would you say?
So I'm pretty much everything people.
Okay.
So, like I said, I'm a life coach, I'm an author, a motivational speaker, I've done counseling. All of my occupations in the past have been with people. So,
mm-hmm.
I was a principal of a private school.
Really?
Was a manager for Delta. I've managed Marriott hotels, everything people interacting. So, and every job that I've had, everybody's always come to me for advice or perspective. They actually deemed me, I came up with this nickname where I was Mr. Perspective at Marriott, where literally people just bring me their problems, you know, and I just always had a knack for people and navigating the spaces. So I decided, hey, why not get paid to do what I actually love to do?
Like it chose you.
Yes, it chose me. So that's how I got into life coaching and definitely just been helping people, building people. I'm everything people.
And so how long have you been independent in doing that?
So I've been independent. So here's the thing. On the occupational side, I'm also a consultant. So I do media and business consulting, consulting of all aspects. I also work in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. I do trainings and courses and online for major companies like Microsoft, Marriott, Delta. So that's what I do occupationally. Consulting on the life coaching side, I've probably been doing that for about 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about the consulting space that you work in? That's got to be difficult.
Yes.
That is something I would not. I mean, me being me, I would not want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like consulting just because I don't mind being the bad guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm the friend that I always tell my friends, whatever you do, don't let me be wrong. If you see me going down an alley and you know there are 6 dogs that are mm-hmm. unchained, don't let me go down the alley. Somebody say something to me. So I love the truth and honesty, you know, aspect of interaction. So when I do consulting, I have a firm but yet accessible approach. I look for entry points, you know, because nobody likes to just be told what to do,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's almost about trying to find, I call it the airplane method. You know what I mean? Like with a baby, you feed them peas. They hate the peas. They spit it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's all over the place. You take that same scoop of peas and you go, and you start going up in the air and do loop-de-loops and make it, now the presentation makes it appealing.
Yeah.
Now the baby wants these same peas that they couldn't stand before.
Okay.
So it's finding the airplane that makes the information palatable for whoever I'm dealing with.
Okay.
So I find different knacks, and I love it actually because, you know, I just want to see everybody win.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people feel that genuine energy, they always open up, well, what can I do? How can I be better? I work heavy in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space, but I approach it more so from a unification standpoint. You know,
yeah.
I always hear the aspect of diversity and inclusion from more of a antagonistic angry, you know, and I'm not knocking anybody, but I'm just more about unifying people, you know.
Okay, so, that's what I was going to add, like specifically in equity and inclusion. Have you had pushback and is that provided some challenges?
Yes. So that the space in itself has been fun for me because I think everything is what you make it. You know, everybody's not going to like you. You're not going to be everybody's slice of cake or cup of tea. Mm-hmm. It's about finding your audience. And there are some places where I've been in where I've been extremely well received. Some places were very tight-lipped and didn't like the approach or the information. The reality is that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, I never let anything affect me. So a couple of things I'm giving tidbits in the programs I do with my clients. I call it the shooter's mentality.
Okay, what's that?
Right. So Steph Curry, greatest shooter of all time, right? I've seen him come out and go 5 for 36 some games.
Yeah.
Right? Just missing a whole bunch of shots. But he keeps shooting because he knows that all I got to do is make one. And the shooter's mentality is they move quickly from the last miss.
Yeah.
They quickly disconnect from it. They miss a shot. They come right back down the court. They're going to shoot it up again because they know that they're not defined by their misses.
Mm.
Right? Mm. So I can miss 16 shots in a row and still believe that I'm going to hit the 17th.
Yeah.
And most people miss 2-3 shots, and then their mind takes over, and now they're out of the game.
I know. You know, can you tell me, like, that is a mentality that I've never really understood.
Yeah.
I feel like I just keep going
and
just like, I don't know if I dismiss the faults because you want to reflect and learn from them, but I'm pretty good at, like, I'm just going to block it out or dismiss it. I don't know if that's good or not. You're the coach, you know?
It's but good, like, but yeah, you're the anomaly, though. Most people are, and I always say you're not defined by your mistakes. You're developed by them. And most people, they have a mistake, and it is crippling.
Do you see that a lot in the professional spectrum? Really?
A lot.
On corporate level stuff as well?
Especially in corporate level, because people get so tight-lipped when they're dealing with money.
Yeah.
Right? So now, if they made a mistake and it didn't work and they lost money, now they're really scared to do anything out of the box. So now it's like, no, I can't do that anymore because I lost this money. My shareholders and stakeholders were unhappy. You know, all the big bosses, the presidents, the CEOs, all of them were unhappy. So now I can't make a move. So it becomes crippling in their career. And it's almost like, okay, cool. I understand that that was a mistake. But the worst thing that you can do is have a mistake and not extract the information that was necessary for you to learn from that mistake. Most people just, they stay in the feeling of the mistake and never get the foundation of, okay, what did I do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What did I do right? How can I learn from this? And how can I make this better?
Do you think that there's a lot of shame involved that keeps people stuck from making mistakes like that?
Yeah, especially corporate sector because everybody's looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got a lot of people depending on, and not just in corporate sector, I see it in families.
Yeah.
When I'm dealing with parents and spouses, and especially in men, is, you know, they're scared to make a mistake because you got a wife and kids that are depending on you.
Yeah.
It's almost like you can't afford to make a mistake. You know, see it in wives. I see it in children. People just don't want to disappoint people, you know. And when they get to that place, it literally locks up their potential. Literally. And they can't move. I got to come in with the sledgehammer and I got to knock down the walls and we got to dig up some dirt. And, you know, we got to do the dirty work.
Well, when you first started doing this, so when did you make the leap? 6 years ago was when you went full time doing what you do now?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about one of the biggest mistakes you've made along the way that you've learned a lot from?
So early on, one of the biggest mistakes I made was trying to project what I thought was right onto someone else.
Oh, yeah.
So my job as a coach is not to tell you what's right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's to help navigate you through the journey to finding your answers. Because your answers are different from my answers.
You know, there are a lot of people who coach and do training or whatnot who don't have that approach. And I'm going to say, like, I'll go to some things and I'm like, I feel like it's hard now to find a good leader.
Sure.
You know?
Yes.
Okay, and so how can you give me an example of, like, when you were...
So I was dealing with this guy, and he really wanted to make some changes in the aspect of his relationship with his wife. And he was doing all of these different things that just were not right. And I could see the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't see it. So my thought process was, okay, I know exactly how to fix this. Because if you do this, this is going to elicit this response,
yeah.
right? So I told him, I said, okay, this is what you do. You take this, you give this to her, you do this, and you do that. And so he says, okay, cool. So then he goes, he does that, but she is not the type of woman who responds to what I told him to do.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, you know, some women are not flowers and candy and romance.
Yeah.
Some women are more practical. They want you to do the stuff that they ask for. They want you to fix the toilet. Mm-hmm. You know, so you bringing roses doesn't fix the toilet. So he goes and does these amazing gestures that I tell him very creative, very unique to her personality. And she literally is like, what is this going to do for me? And it becomes this entire argument. They blow up and he comes back to me like, you told me. And I said, you know what? That's my bad. Let's go back to the drawing board. I told you what I thought was going to work because this is what I know to do. And so it's just finding the ways that I can lead people to their answers and knowing that every situation is unique. There are no two people that are alike. No two people have the same fingerprint.
Mm-hmm.
So no two people have the same journey or process. Now, there may be parts of it that are similar.
Yeah.
But no two people have the same exact process. And when you try to align or parallel your process to someone else, then you fall victim to certain things that this person has to go through that you wouldn't have to go through if you were just stuck in your lane.
Ooh, yeah.
So now you welcome in all these different aspects of process and pain because you didn't stick to your process. You didn't stay in your lane. You want to do what you see on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do what you see on social media or these celebrities. Okay, cool. You got to understand that some of these celebrities have millions of dollars at their disposal.
Yeah.
You don't. So we got to find what works for you.
Oh, well, can we unpack that for a second?
Yeah.
How do you think, like, within your work, does social media play a big part in some misalignment?
Yeah. It's definitely huge because we're visual creatures,
mm-hmm.
right? And social media has become the new norm of what reality should be. I say all reality is adopted reality. It doesn't matter where you come from. You could literally put two people in the same situation and they'll have two totally different outcomes because one person has adopted a certain reality of where they are and the other person adopted an entirely different reality.
Hmm.
Like I've seen it to where two people have been in, I've seen two kids that literally grew up in the same projects. One decided that this is life. I need to get into the street game. I need to do this. Another person said, my way out is in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Study hard, got 4.0, literally got scholarships to Harvard and went on to build his business. Same place, different realities.
Yeah.
So everything is adopted reality. So everything, every time when we spend, and one of the exercises I like to do, I go into my phone and I check my screen times of what I spend the most time on my phone on. And most people spend so much time on social media and they look at it. And the more you look at it, the more it connects into your mind, the more it connects into your heart. Everything starts in the thought, right? I call it the tea party. So it's thoughts, emotions, actions. So everything, the way I give my thoughts direction is by what I'm constantly feeding myself. So what I'm feeding myself into my eyes, into my ears, what I'm listening is shaping the way I'm thinking. So if I'm always seeing this on social media, then I'm thinking that the only way that I can be happy is if I have this.
Oh, yeah.
So then now that filters down into my emotions as I start feeling some type of way about where I am currently in life. Because I'm always looking at someone else's version of life because that's not even their life.
Yeah.
It's their version of what they're presenting. So I'm looking at someone else's version of life and saying, you know what? They look happy. I must not be happy where I am.
Mm-hmm.
I got to have this in order to be happy.
Oh, man. I do it all the time. I'm on such, like, I'm a, you know, a professional influencer.
Yeah,
and I'm garbage at it. I'll just be real honest. There's a certain part of me that truly intrinsically believes that it is bad for humanity.
Yeah.
And I am supposed to be in it. And I'm like, this is bad for all of us.
Yeah.
Like, it's bad for me. I don't believe in this.
Yeah.
And that being said, I mean, I have negative, I'll go through slumps too. I'm scrolling too much and I'm like, why am I standing on top of a mountain weighing 120 pounds?
Exactly.
And how come I'm not on a balloon ride? Yeah. Or I'm never going to meet a man like that or have friends like that. Look at all these people with all these great friends and these amazing parties. And
private
I'm like, what?
Private jets, sipping champagne.
Right?
I can't even get Fiji water. We got regular water, tap water at my house.
Just regular water. We just got regular water. I'm a regular water type of gal. And like, no, but for sure. And it, I feel like it's something that everybody knows it's happening, but we're all still doing it anyway.
Yeah.
And I feel like, what do we do? Where do we go from there?
Yeah. But see, I think the issue is that, you know, and the saying goes that evil triumphs when good people do nothing, right? So there is a lot of good that can come out of social media. People have literally made established livings for their family and created a whole new life via social media. But it's like anything can become a drug if you allow it to. Like it's just about maintaining certain disciplines of, like, for instance, for me, certain things that I do to keep me on track, keep me motivated. Like, there are places in the house where I would normally put up sticky notes that have certain messages on it that keeps me, when I see it, it motivates me to stay on track, right? Mm-hmm. So there are timers that I put on my phone that make sure that I have this amount of time to do this amount of time to do that, and that's with everything, right? In the second book that I'm writing, it's a leadership book. Mm-hmm. And one of the aspects that I talk about is the unspoken grief that leaders have, right? And they carry a lot of the grief of either loss, failure, holding on to it, and they are scared to let it out because they fear that if I go into that space, I won't come out of it, right? So I developed this process and principle called grieve and go.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a basketball, you know, terminology where the play is called the give and go,
mm-hmm.
where I give you the pass, you know, give you the ball, and then I set the pick and I roll to the basket and I'm expecting to get the ball when I should be open.
Yes.
So it's literally, it's similar to that. I give myself specific time frames to grieve. And then when that time is up, I got to get up and go.
What do you mean grieving? Grieving what?
Anything. So people think grief can only be from the aspect of losing a loved one, right, or something traumatic. But if you lose a job, there's a level of grief that you have from the loss, right? People think that, okay, and what happens is we think that it has to be this grand thing for me to really address it, and we ignore all of the minute things, the small things, the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't address the cracks, they become canyons. Right. So it's literally if there's a relationship that ends, there's a level of grief there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If there is a job that's lost through this pandemic, it's a level of grief there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just the uncertainty or the frustration or the hurt of it. There's a level of grief because life changed.
You know, what's crazy is I'm all into self-improvement or whatnot, but I never went into the grief space until recently. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine is on the board of this nonprofit, and he asked me to go to like a fundraiser or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's called Companions on a Journey. And I learned so much about grief and so much about how every human being is grieving.
Yeah.
And like why the majority of mental health issues, addiction issues, any other sort of like anger,
mm-hmm.
all stems from grief.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how have I never heard this before?
Oh, yeah.
And no one is putting any attention on grief when it is something that really binds us all.
Yes.
More so, I mean, I feel like it's one of like the main emotions humans feel every day, and no one talks about it.
Yeah. And because from a child, you're taught to shake it off.
Yeah.
Right? You're taught that, okay, oh, you're not hurt. Oh, stop crying. So we become masters of compartmentalization from a young child because I learned how to tuck my pain. Because normally for me, I get hurt and they say, oh, shake it off or you're not hurt. That's telling me in my mind, okay, well, then I need to, what I'm feeling right now, I need to get rid of some kind of way. So now that I become an adult who became a master at compartmentalizing my pain, when something happens, I just tuck it away. Mm. And now I'm a master at internalizing. And I could smile and be broken. and I could be happy in your face, but really I'm super frustrated.
Is there something that happened to you that made you lean into the grief space? Like, where have you always been like that?
Yeah, so like for me, my when my grandmother died in 2011, she was my world, right? And when she passed, it when she passed, it shook me. But I didn't have the time to really grieve properly. She died in the morning. I had to do a conference that night. So I literally never had the time to stop and really just deal. It was one of those things that I'm in pieces, but now I gotta somehow put some Gorilla Glue on these pieces, some duct tape, and some wrapping paper, and be good for the people that that need me now in this moment.
Wow. How did it show up in other places of your life?
Yeah, so there would be times where and you can always identify someone who has unresolved grief is because they always overreact and they attack petals, right? Instead of roots. So something small could be you know, you asked them for a pen and you gave them a pencil and they blow up because they asked for a pen.
Oh yeah.
Why wouldn't you give me what I asked for? That's not really the issue.
Yeah.
There's some unresolved grief underneath that we haven't dealt with, and now you're responding to petals. Like literally every little thing. If somebody does something the wrong way or turns something wrong, people are blowing up because they have all this packed in grief that they haven't addressed. And it's going to come out.
Yeah.
And everybody, and that's the thing, is that we pack it and pack it and pack it for so long that now your threshold, you're at your max. You're at your max emotional threshold. And now everything is a trigger.
Oh, gosh,
and the issue is because now you have so many layers of the grief that now when it's time to address it, you got to go through all of these layers to get back down to the root. And nobody really wants to take that deep dive because now you've packed so much, we got to peel back a bunch of layers of hurt, a bunch of unresolved stuff. And that ain't fun.
No, it's
it is not fun pulling back all those layers, but it's so necessary. And that's the real benefit of having someone who can guide through the journey, because trying to do it alone, you'll get lost.
And
if you just start it with someone and then try to take it over, you still get lost, because pain is one of those. It's one of those things that has no boundary. You can't say, okay, I'm only going to allow pain to affect this portion of me. When you're hurt, when you stub your toe, your whole body shuts down. It's going to shut down, literally. I said in my book that's out, it's called When Life Happens. When you I use the analogy of when you get up in the morning, it's dark, sleeping, and you stub your toe on the way to go use the restroom. And it hurts and it's crippling. But you have the choice to say, okay, do I stay here and worry about the fact that my toe is hurting, I can't see, I'm barely asleep, and end up using the bathroom by myself? Or do I keep pushing because I have somewhere to go? And that's the ability of finding the tools and the tactics that when you stub your toe, okay, now what? What do we do now? Because we're not negating that it hurt.
Well, yeah. Can we talk about your book more?
Yeah. So my book is called When Life Happens. Mm-hmm. It's the subtitle is How to Go from Trap to Triumph.
I know. I love
that. Yeah. So it's the blueprint to breakthrough. It's life's playbook. It's literally everything. It's how to proactively prepare for the storms of life or for the issues of life, how to successfully matriculate through them, and how to recover after them. Right. Mm. Because life happens to us all. So how do you deal? One of the chapters called What the Heck Was That? And that's literally the chapter about the one hit that has the ability to shake your entire foundation is the one you didn't see coming.
Okay. Like, what do you mean?
It's like a sucker punch or a tornado.
Okay.
It's something that you can't prepare for. So it's almost like you get hit and you go, what the heck was that? Like, where did that come from? Who hit me? How did this? So what do you do in those spaces where you've been planning, you've been preparing, and then now something just comes out of left field like a pandemic and wipes you out? What do you do then? You know, so there is tools and tactics. A couple of my favorite chapters were, and they actually go back to back. The first chapter it's not the first chapter in the book, but the one chapter in the series is called I Got It.
Okay.
I'm the king. Well, I used to be the king of I Got It. Don't worry. No, I got it. So when there was something to where I had too much on me or people wanted to help me or I needed help, I was always, no, I got it. Don't worry about it. No, I'm good. Don't worry about it. And so people be like, hey, you know, you okay? Yeah, I'm good. Don't worry about it. I'm good. I got it. You know, literally. So funny story. So one night, I was carrying there was like 8 bags in the car, and me and Stephanie got out, and I was getting all the bags. She was like, look, you know, let me get some bags. I said, no, I got it. Don't worry about it. I got it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the man. I got it. I'm getting all the bags. She said, no, let me help you. I said, I got it. Don't worry about it. So I'm getting the bags and the food. I drop the food. She looks at me. She says, let me be your teammate. And I said,
"Whoa, she is your person."
Yeah, and I said, "See, now you speak in my language."
Yeah, that's phenomenal response to that.
That was huge because I'm so used to, and life forced me into that position. Unfortunately, because there were times where I needed people and looked to people, and I was always the one to get in the last end of the stick, you know, or people let me down, or there were disappointments, or people that I needed. In moments was like, yeah, I got you, but then they never have you. Mm-hmm. So then I learned to, nobody's going to have my back, I need to be able to have myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I built this wall to protect me from disappointment, but I also, the wall prevented me from accessing the help that I needed.
Yeah.
So then the next chapter after that is the power of vulnerability.
Yeah, and in letting the ego go.
Yes,
yeah? So
yes.
I feel like now I'm speaking your language, or I'm into that stuff, and I feel like every time, and I willingly will be like, I shouldn't do this. My ego's telling me yes, but I'm gonna fuck it. I'm gonna do it anyway.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Yeah.
Karma comes back like almost instantly. Yeah. Every single time. Yeah. You're like, why don't you ever learn? I'm like, no. There's still part of me that's just like, nah, fuck you.
Yeah.
I hate to say it like that. But I feel like there's something within me that's I have such a problem with authority.
Okay.
That even like within my own brain of authority of logic and reason, I'm like, nah, just because I'm gonna say no.
Okay, so where did that start?
I mean, think forever. I've always been like the rebel.
Okay.
A self-sacrificing rebel, I would say.
Sure.
Since the time I was a little kid.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But so there was nothing like in terms of like parents or somebody who you had a difficult time with in authority?
Oh, both of them.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. They're both. It's a mess.
Yeah.
It's a mess. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
So in that aspect, did you sort of develop this self-will, like I have to be the one to make the decision?
Yeah, I think so. You know what? Yeah. I was like, I'm the middle of 5 kids.
Yeah.
And like always growing up. In every situation, if any situation needed a volunteer,
mm-hmm.
I would wait. Nobody would volunteer. Yeah. Always, I'd be like, "Well, fine, then I'll just do it."
Yeah.
Come on, let's just get this thing going.
Yeah.
Like from forever, that's just always been me.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I feel like that's just kind of still how I am now.
Yeah.
But that's been like forever. Even like I remember have vivid memories of even my older brothers being too scared to like go down in the basement to turn the light on when they were kids. And I'd be well, then I'll do it.
Yeah.
Like, come on, we got to go. Like, we got to watch the Trolls movie or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But I just have always been like that.
Yeah.
So.
And so in that type of scenario sort of creates the complex that, okay, nobody else is going to make the decision. I don't trust anybody to make the decision because it's been modeled to me that the people that I'm around and really depend on won't make the decision. So I got to be the one. So now every decision I have to make, and if there's somebody else who's going against it, now if there's an authority figure who's trying to say this is that, okay, no, I don't trust that. I need to make the decision. And whatever the decision is, even in terms of trying to logicalize it in my head, it creates that microcosm of now I go back and forth with, even within myself, but having someone else make the decision for me, that's a no-go.
Oh, yeah.
That's a no-go.
I mean, I feel even just like laws in general. I'm just like, human free will all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm a good person. It'll all be fine. But like, that's not always how it works.
No.
Like, no. That's really
when you see
not
the police car behind you.
Like,
yeah.
Really, that's not how it works.
Oh,
yeah. Wow. I'm gonna like, you just solved all the problems. Oh, that's phenomenal. Well, so how, can you tell me about like your experiences learning in similar situations? Like, how was your upbringing?
Yeah, I was very much, very similar. I'm an alpha personality. I've always been the one who just either had the better idea or I felt like I had the better idea, or I've been put in situations where I had to grow up fast. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like my mom I was raised by a single mom, and seeing her, how hard she was working in order to try to take care of me and my siblings, and, you know, and then my sister had a small child at the time. I started working at 16, right? My senior year, I was working 2 full-time jobs.
Wow.
And it became to the place where, you know what, I see the issue, and instead of being a part of the issue and saying this is what I need, or the place that I'm at, or the place that I'm lacking, I said, you know what, I see the struggle, I see how hard she's working. I'm just going to take whatever's dealing with me, I'm going to internalize it, and then I'm going to start making the decisions for me over here. So then I grew up, and now pretty much majority of decisions that I've made, good and bad, I've been okay with because they were my decision. Because at least I have the power, right? Because if I give you the power to make the decision and you make the wrong one, then now I have the consequence of your wrong decision.
Yeah.
At least I can be okay if it's my bad decision. So it was like it was a control thing for me. I like to be in control because I generally believe that I have the best idea. So if I'm in a room and I this is cool, but I think I know better.
Yeah.
Let me go ahead and get that. So I was very much like that, and there were times where, you know, literally my whole life was shut down, and I had no choice but to depend on people. Like in 2000, I had a sinus infection that spread to my brain, and I had fluid gathered on the right side of my brain, and I went into the emergency room and had a stroke, and
Whoa.
I was completely paralyzed on the left side of my body.
You were? This was in 2010?
2000.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so literally, I was completely paralyzed from my head to my feet on the left side. They told me that they would tell me to smile. Only the right side of my face would move. They would prick my hands till it bled. I couldn't feel it.
Like cerebral palsy or something?
Yeah, so I had it was just a sinus. It was this weird sinus infection.
Wow.
And fluid gathered up on my brain. And that's this scar here. Actually, I had 2 brain surgeries.
Oh, my God. How does that even happen from a sinus infection? I know that was possible.
I know it. So this scar above my eye, they literally put a tube. There's maybe about a 2 to 3 inch tube over in my head. And they would come in and drain fluid from my brain several times throughout the day. Like, couldn't move, couldn't walk, couldn't do anything.
How long were you? Did you think you were going to be permanently paralyzed?
So I was really out of it. I mean, I really didn't, you know, once I just knew that I was having these headaches that were so excruciating. When I blinked, it felt like my head was going to explode. I couldn't really breathe. It was so painful. So when I went in and I went to the bathroom, and I was coming out of the bathroom, and I was dragging my left side, literally, like I was limp, and I was dragging it. And so, you know, when I went through the process of, I was in there two and a half months, 2 brain surgeries, tubes everywhere.
Oh, my gosh.
And it literally, so the doctors didn't know what was wrong with me. They just couldn't figure it out because it was so crazy. Like, they had never seen something like this transition to this. So they literally were bringing specialists in, and they pretty much were prepping to say, you know, that I was going to die. And if I live, that I would be a vegetable. So it really just speaks to how literally God has shut down the entire world at times, and you have no choice but to rely. You have no choice but to go through the process. So I had to learn everything over again. They fed me on the feeding tube because I couldn't eat.
Oh, my God. Talk about what a life-changing experience.
Listen, so they literally, my one of the first day in physical therapy, one of the most humbling experiences in my life.
Yeah.
I was went to physical therapy, and the physical therapist said, okay, today we're going to practice buttoning a shirt. And I said, I don't want to practice buttoning a shirt. I want to walk. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been immobilized for 2 months, haven't been able to use my body at all. I want to walk. And she said, well, the issue is that you think that you know how to button a shirt, but your system literally has done a hard reset, and now you have to retrain your body to do everything. My mind knew how to button a shirt. I know the mechanisms. It's not like I'm unaware. But she said, but you don't know, or you're unaware of the damage that's been done to you. So we need to start here. And I argue back and forth with her. No, I need to walk. I know how to button a shirt. She said, okay, cool, deal. This is what I'll do. I'm going to put this shirt on you. If you can button it, then we'll try to walk. She put the shirt on me, and my hands would not work. I knew what to do. And we take that for granted, that you literally can think and I can ball a fist, mm-hmm. right? That I can literally just, I can send the signal from my brain to my hand to make a fist.
Yeah.
And literally, there was a short circuit within the signals to where my body would not work. Even though I knew what to do, man, I physically could not do it. And I sat there, tears rolling down my face. It was the most humbling experience in my life, because I realized then how much damage had been done.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of people, is that we go through these situations that are extremely damaging mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically, and we just keep moving, thinking that, okay, because I'm aware of what I need to do moving forward, that I don't have to address the damage that's been done to me.
Mm-hmm.
And now we get into the next situation and we wonder why parts of me don't work. Parts of my heart don't work. Parts of my ability to be present don't work, because I didn't stop to address the fact that my last issue made me immobilized from being fully present in this moment. And until we stop and go back and do the dirty work of saying, you know what, I don't know how to button a shirt. Let's start here.
Wow.
Then I won't even get to be able to where I can get up and walk properly. And so now I'll get up and I may be moving, but I will still be dysfunctional. So I'll be moving and I'll have motion, but I won't be walking correctly.
Whoa.
So, yeah.
When you were laying there for 2.5 months,
mm-hmm.
what was the one recurring memory that went through your mind more than anything else?
I really didn't have memories. I just wanted to get out.
Yeah.
You know, and I really, for a minute there, you know, I almost gave up,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it was just so bad, you know. And this, here's the thing. I had no history. There was no issues. I was healthy. I was playing sports. I was not a sick person.
Mm-hmm.
I had never been to the hospital. So this is my real first experience, other than when I was a baby and had a double hernia. But this is my first experience in the hospital, and this is a life-threatening situation.
Yeah.
So I have no point of reference. So I'm entering into this new phase, this new space, and I literally have no blueprint. I have no guide to say, okay, this is what you do here. These are the feelings that you're going to feel. This is how you meant. So now I'm in it, and I'm just trying to figure it out. And that's most of us in life. I'm just in it trying to figure it out.
Do you feel that experience kind of set the stage for where you are now?
Oh, yes.
It made you, like, just really stop.
Yes.
Really stop.
Yes.
Think about it all.
Yes.
My gosh.
That's why, even with the pandemic, I had a different perspective, because my life had been shut down before. You know,
mm-hmm.
I know what it's like to be moving and then all of a sudden you can't go anywhere.
Wow.
So it's being able to take the lessons of the last issue, the last hurt, the last letdown, the last disappointment, and being able to bring them into your present so that the situations and things that you're going through won't negatively impact your future. So it's just literally just stringing it all together. And a lot of people just leave out of situations and they want to detach from it because it hurt.
Yeah. And then it comes back, and then they're angry,
mm-hmm.
and they're mean.
But then we're able to do that when it's things like working out.
What do you mean?
Working out doesn't feel good.
No, it does. Well,
it hurts.
It does, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're really working out, like, consistently, and you're pushing your body, mm-hmm. and you're under weights, and you're under tension, and you're under pressure, when you leave out, if you really got a good workout,
yeah.
it should hurt.
Oh, yeah.
Something should be sore. You should, the next day, you should feel it, you know. You know, now there are times where you may go in and it just may be a light workout and just something that, you know, but like, I don't feel like I had a good workout unless
you feel the burn. I love the burn.
Yeah.
So I'm all there for it. I go way wicked ham. I injure myself all the time, actually, because
literally, if I don't feel like I'm about to die, I don't feel like I worked hard enough. I want to literally be walking up and people asking me, yo, you okay? Yeah, man, just a good workout, you know. So I like to push myself to that limit, you know, because it hurts. But I push myself there because I know that this pain is working for my end goal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm willing to endure this pain because I know the results that I'm trying to get.
Within your, just to speak about fitness for a sec, I'm a fitness freak myself.
Come on.
In your life coaching, in your curriculum, I'd say, do you endorse exercise?
Yes.
For everybody?
Yes.
Me too.
Yes.
That's the first thing I tell everybody is like, get your butt on a walk. At least start walking or something outside.
Yeah. You gotta get your body moving, because the more you sit and remain stationary and stagnant, the more you allow your thoughts to really take over. Mm-hmm. Like, you'd be surprised at how much there are tools and ways that I tell people how you give your thoughts direction. It's one of the main things is what you say, right? It's impossible to think one thing and say another thing simultaneously.
Correct.
I can't say something right now in this moment and my mind be on a completely different thought in that same moment. So if I am always speaking something positive in my life, if I'm always reaffirming purpose and destiny, my goals and my dreams, that I can make it, that this won't break me, I don't die here, my thoughts will always be on those type of thoughts. But if I'm constantly reaffirming my adopted reality, this didn't work. Oh, another failed relationship. I'm going to be alone forever. This job didn't work out. I'll never get the job that I want. I'm behind on my bills. I'll never. Then your thoughts will always be on the never. And then your emotions will reflect the never. And then your body will then respond with never energy.
Yes.
And nobody likes people with never energy.
No, not at all. That's
I can't stand
true.
People with never energy. When you go up to them, hey, how you doing? I'm like, okay, all right. Well, I'm going to go this way. You go that way. And, we'll call it a day.
When did you get into mind, body, and soul, spirit alignment, that type of stuff? Because I feel like that's what you just described.
Yeah. I've always been a totality type of person.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that everything is connected.
Yeah.
That, you know, the things that happen in your mind affect what happens to your body. Mm-hmm. And that's even from a physiological standpoint, that stress is not a physical thing, but it affects your physical body.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like through your blood and your cortisone levels and blood pressure, high blood pressure, low blood pressure, aneurysms, a lot of them are related to stress-related type of situations.
This is kind of random. Mm-hmm. My mom told me recently, my mom has a disease similar to ALS.
Okay.
And she told me recently she watched a Netflix documentary called Heal.
Mm.
I don't know, but it's all about the power. I haven't seen it, but it's all about the power. And I'm into this a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But the power of your mind, and how their whole thing is that your mind can heal anything, whatever exactly that means. I don't know if your mind is going to stop your cut from bleeding.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah, it may not
but
be
internally,
that. Unless you're Wolverine, unless you're X-Men, we don't know about, then that might be. But it does, like the mind is the most powerful thing that a person possesses,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we spend so little time really building and strengthening and making sure that our mind is healthy. We don't do healthy mind activities. We don't do healthy mind process. We are filtering our mind with so much junk, so much negativity, so much violence, so much just all around junk. And then we expect our bodies and our hearts to be able to produce at high levels. everything starts in the thought.
Have you had trouble with toxic masculinity and men?
Yes.
I feel like it's more women than men who talk the way that you do and do what you do.
Yeah.
And do you see that often?
Yes. Men have this innate ability to believe that they are right. Always. Always.
Yeah, some women too.
Yeah. Like, we have this thing that because men are logical, they feel like their logic is the best because in the past, their logic may have worked for them. So if someone goes out and they are into archery and they draw the bow a specific way and they hit the target bullseye, because they hit it that one time, they think that how they shoot is the right way. Then if you get a professional archer who comes in and say, hey, let me fine tune your form so I can help you. No, I'm good because I hit dead center on a bullseye the way I did it. Okay, but you hit it dead center one time. I'm trying to develop practice of you hitting dead center every time. And most men feel like, you know, especially when another man is trying to tell you what to do or how to move, they all automatically, this male bravado, they feel like they have to posture up, you know, and then they want to become, you know. But here's the thing. I'm the alpha in any situation. You can't muscle the muscle. So I always tell God, listen, please, it's not going to work because one, I'm not threatened by you and I'm confident in me. Those are two things that will always prevent you from getting the upper hand. I'm not threatened by you, and I'm confident in me.
But were you always that way?
No. So I'm telling you one of the things my mom told me, and it freed me. I was young, and I was a people pleaser. Mm-hmm. I just wanted people to be happy, and I didn't understand why people were hating on me, didn't like me for no reason. You just don't like me just because. Like, you never had a conversation with me. Like, why is it that when I walk in, you automatically, your face is turned up? You don't even know me. What's the issue? And I wanted to make people happy. And she sent me aside. I was young. I had to be maybe 6 or 7.
Well.
Yeah, I was young. And she said, you know, baby, they hated Jesus and he was perfect. You think they ain't gonna hate you? And for some reason that clicked in me, right? And I was like, you know what? These folk ain't gonna like me. That, okay, cool. So I became accustomed and okay with, like, when I enter in the room, I always get the negative energy from a lot of people.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, just because they're intimidated.
Exactly.
You're an intimidating person.
But I love that energy. When I walk into a room, I love walking in and people looking like, oh, you think you are. I love it. I have no problem being the bad guy.
You know what's crazy is I didn't get that at all. You don't. All right, so that's definitely haters, people who need to level up.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you and your I keep wanting to say wife, but you and Stephanie together, are overwhelming. But you're so kind and warm and welcoming. There is nothing that is. I mean, it's intimidating because you guys are so tall and so beautiful and like great. Great aura, great energy. But there's nothing that's like, I don't think that he thinks he's anything at all. Not even close. That didn't cross my mind.
But people who are not confident in themselves will automatically take your confidence as a threat. People who are insecure will always take your security as an act of war. When you walk in secure in who you are, when you're smiling, when you're greeting everybody, you'd be surprised. And it's mostly in spaces and pockets where, like you said, where the people are insecure. But in spaces where I deal with a lot of people, right? And then I enter a lot of rooms where there are a bunch of people. And you can just see it. You see the side eyes. You see the eye rolls. You see all of the different things that happen. And I love it.
To be honest, like, that's what okay, so I can imagine that sometimes it would make your job more difficult when you come into a room and you got to tell a corporate-ass man. Let me be classy about it. You need to tell
a corporate man. No, do you? You ain't got to do that.
You got to tell this corporate man, like, you're not that, I know, like, say HR hired you.
Yeah.
And then you have to go into a room and tell all these other men all this stuff. I could see that it would be difficult.
Yes. Yes. Because and here's the thing, is that a lot of people feel like the main issue that I run into is people have this relatability complex. Mm-hmm. That you can't relate, you don't understand. So you can't tell me anything because you don't get it. You don't understand. If I worked in their field, like say for instance, if I worked here at for the radio station, but I was the senior vice president of the radio station.
Okay.
And I've worked every job, and I came in and I wanted to talk to you about how we want to make some changes, how we can improve X, Y, and Z. You'd be more inclined to listen to me because of my experience here. Mm-hmm. But if I'm just a consultant off the street and I come in and I'm trying to talk to you about the radio station, what we could do, how we could improve it, you're more inclined to say, you're not even in radio. How can you tell me what to do here? You don't work here.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it's the relatability complex. And then people always want to say, you don't get it. You don't understand. You don't know what you're talking about. And I'll say, okay, cool, I understand. But see, it's ways that I now, and what happens is I just have to do more work breaking down the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I break down the walls and I show them that there are certain universal principles that we can fine tune and tweak in every situation that will make you more successful, then they say, oh, wow, okay, I didn't see it from that point of view. I know. So, but it's just the doing the work of breaking down the walls, because the end result is I'm here to see you win, and when I leave, you're going to be in a winning position. It's just either you're going to be willing to accept my help, or I got to bring out the sledgehammer, we're tear down the walls, and then we'll waste the time of breaking that down before we actually get into the winning.
Oh man, that's tough. Like that's the ego and pride right there.
Yeah.
You know, like somebody told me recently, I was having a freak out day and they were like, "Nat, everybody's on Team Nat, okay?
Yeah.
You're the only one who's not.
Yeah.
Everyone's else on Team Nat. You need to calm down."
Yeah.
I'm like, "Okay, you're right."
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you could give advice to someone who is thinking about doing, I don't know, changing their lives in any sort of way, what are like some simple, easy steps you would recommend to someone?
One, first thing I always suggest, and I put this in my book too, is the quote is, show me your friends, I'll show you your future. Check your connections. Who are you around? You cannot foster positive life environment, life experiences, positive pursuit of purpose around negative people, around people who are even have good intentions but may not be good for the space that you're in, right? And a lot of times we are loyal to people because of tenure. I grew up with you, right? We've been friends for this long. Okay, I understand that. But if you are saying that you want to be here, then the first thing you have to do is see the people who I am around, do they foster the journey for me getting from where I am to where I want to be? And if not, then that doesn't mean I got to cut everybody off, but then maybe I need to start being more strategic with my time, my access. Because if I give, say for instance, if I need an hour a day to work on, which is what I suggest, hour a day to work on my goals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in that hour, I give you 20 minutes of laughing, talking, joking on the phone, right? Now, although there's nothing wrong with laughing, talking, joking on the phone, I now only have 40 minutes, which then puts me in a time crunch, which then makes me rush, which then makes me miss something, which then makes me mess up.
Which then makes me angry.
Yes. So that's the first thing, is I gotta check who I am around.
Yeah,
right. I got to see I have curriculum and tools of how to be able to put people in the proper categories of what they add and what they subtract from your life. Right. So I take people through the connection chart. Let's put everybody on the chart where they're connected. And let's now see how we can align the pieces that provide me the best process of getting to my area of purpose and destiny that I desire. So first, I always tell people check their connections. Two, the next thing I always do is we got to go back before we can go forward. Before we can even get to life changing, let's look at life now. How do we get to where we are? let's unpack some things first, because it makes no sense in trying to build something new on a shaky foundation.
Yeah.
So I got to first check, see who's in my house. Then I got to check the foundation. Right. So after I clean the house, now I can start pulling up the floors. Right. Because you can't start renovating a house with people in it. I got to get people out.
Yep.
So now once I get people out, now I can start pulling up the floors. Let's start doing some digging. Let's check this foundation. Let's find the cracks. Right. Mm-hmm. And then after we find the cracks, then like I have tools and curriculum on how we can fill the cracks. Is it a completely gut mission or gut job from the foundation? Do we have to pull everything out and then relay it, or can we actually patch it up? So there, and a lot of times people just, it's being able to identify if this is a patchable crack or if I need to pull this entire section out, right? Because it's like an iceberg. You only see the tip on the top, but the mass is underneath. So if I only think that this is just a little bit at the top of the surface, mm-hmm. then I never do the deep digging. So, those are a couple things that I start with.
I'm just now racking my brain of like, well, I need to sign up for this. Yeah. Like, I'm down. I love self-improvement so much. Yeah. Everybody can always do some, and I feel like it makes you a better human, and you walk around happier and lighter.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yes.
I feel like there's so much. I feel like everybody has grief, trauma in some sort of way.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But then there's also the thing is, the more you do that, then the more narrow, which I guess is great, though. Yeah. Then, like, the more narrow the people that you can vibe with.
Exactly.
Because you're like, well.
Exactly.
All right, well.
Yeah.
Once you wake up, you cannot be unwoken.
Yeah.
You know? Does that make sense? You cannot unwake. You cannot go back to sleep.
I can't sleep again.
You know what I'm Anyway, William Jackson, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, Natalie, thank you for having me. I appreciate
Tell me more
you.
About, and I also love this, is that this was a total really great way that we met.
Yeah.
And usually, you know, it was just like, it just so happened, it happened in chance. And we were like, you need to go and tell me your story. Where can people find you? And what is the name of your second book coming out?
Awesome. So my website is www.theofficialwilliamjackson.com, right? So that's my website that has my book on there, all of my curriculum. Actually, I'm launching the end of this week. I'm doing a 21-day purpose plan that'll go live on my site.
Wow.
And literally, it's going to walk you through 21 days of how to discover purpose, how to embrace it, and how to walk it out. So 21 days, it takes 21 days to develop any habit. So I'm launching that at the end of the week. That'll be live on the site. I'm really excited about that. So that's my website, theofficialwilliamjackson.com. My Instagram is theofficialwilliamjackson as well. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of my good nuggets and willpower moments are. And then the name of my next book is actually called Top Heavy.
Okay.
And it's called The Weight of the Vision.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it's literally trying to lead from the aspect where you have the weight of what you've been called to do, what you've been created to do.
Oh, that speaks to me for sure. How do you do? I feel like that stresses me out more than anything.
Yeah.
People always say I'm hard on myself. I'm like, but you don't understand what is going on in my brain, where I'm going.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how to get there.
Yeah. And I am I'm extremely hard on myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm extremely hard on myself. But one of the things that I'm learning to do, really Stephanie is helping me with this, is being able to be okay with not being perfect.
Ooh.
Right? Some of the stuff that's in the book too as well. It's learning how to lead and be okay as an imperfect leader. So it's oxymoronic, because as a leader, you really want to lead perfectly, but that pressure alone will prohibit you from leading effectively.
Yeah. Like, I think there's power in vulnerability, and I feel like it makes you more human.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand how you want to. I mean, I try to perfect my craft every single day.
Yes.
And it's never perfect. Yeah. And then you gotta, I don't know, walk away or move on, but admitting it, that's the only way you grow and to continue to go.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a process, you know, and it's a marathon, not a sprint.
That's true. Hey, if you want to go fast, you go alone. If you want to go far, you go together.
Yes.
So that's very exciting. Yeah. And what are your goals for 2022?
My goals for 2022 is to affect at least 22,000 people to accomplish purpose, destiny, and accomplish their goals in not just the life coaching arena, but the professional sector as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have to look out.
Yeah.
Good luck and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Well, and there you have it. The official William Jackson. Thank you so much for coming on, man. I hope you all enjoyed. Again, you can find him at www.theofficialwilliamjackson.com and on Instagram at William Jackson. And then his book is called When Life Happens. And you can order that online as well. Thank you guys so much. Stay safe and happy new year.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.